This episode is brought to you by Liquid IV. When you hydrate with Liquid IV, you're powered by HydraScience. HydraScience is Liquid IV's science-backed formula with an optimized ratio of electrolytes, vitamins, and nutrients. Experience great-tasting hydration for mental clarity, physical endurance, and overall well-being. Sip into something that up-levels every moment. Liquid IV. Tear. Pour. Live more. Visit us at liquidiv.com.
With Walmart's new Fresh and Frozen subscriptions, you can save time on your weekly grocery shopping.
Dad, you're supposed to be grocery shopping.
And miss the chance to embarrass you in front of your friends? I subscribe to snacks and wet napkins. You know how messy you are.
Dad!
Walmart. Subscribe to your weekly list.
Hey, welcome to another episode. Today's is with Marcus Evans, who is a consultant psychotherapist who worked at the infamous Tavistock Clinic, now known as a house of horrors, where children were having all sorts of permanent body changes. Some go as far as to say mutilated body parts and things like that. I think that's maybe politically charged, and a more neutral way of looking at it is they were having sort of changes to make themselves appear more like the opposite sex. That is now not happening. Tavistock had to close down. Similarly, the NHS only in the last few weeks has now banned puberty blockers on children in the UK. And this raises a really interesting point. Does it mean that the likes of Marcus, who's a whistleblower really from Tavistock, and myself doing this podcast, and Graham Linehan, Kelly J. Keane, there's so many now I've interviewed, so forgive me, I won't be able to list them all. But are we in some sense vindicated? Does this mean that, hey, we've been banging this drum to point this out for years and years, and finally it's gotten to a point where it's so bad that even the NHS, even the people in charge of Tavistock, they've had to cancel what they were doing? Or, if you're an ideologue on the other side of this whole debate or argument, you know, I'm always really into understanding that people have different views and different understandings of things and different values in life. Is it that we in the mainstream have put so much pressure on this, or of really pushed so far against this, even though we're wrong, that the NHS and other institutions have felt compelled to close it down for the time being in what is a, I suppose they would call it an absolute, mistrial of justice, or a really unjust, horrible thing because we're fascist Nazis. I don't know. I obviously opt for the former. I'm sure Marcus Evans does as well, and he's going to be talking about what it was actually like working on the inside at Tavistock and what was going on there, because it's pretty outrageous. I think it will wind a lot of you up. I think it's going to make you angry. I'd love to hear what you guys think. Put it all out on social media. Do give Marcus Evans a big follow. I'll put his stuff in the description, and I'll see you at the end. What is Tavistock? What are some of the horrors that went on there?
The Tavistock is the National Health Service psychotherapy training school. And the JIDS is actually a very small part of the Tavistock. Mm-hmm. So if you thought of a big building with a lot of people having individual therapy, family therapy, group therapy, and then a lot of other people being taught about psychotherapy, that's what the Tavistock is.
Interesting. And what was it that came out a couple of years ago that made it, I guess, infamous around the world?
Well, the Gender Identity Development Service was a long time ago moved into the Tavistock in the early 2000s. It was quite a small service, and it sort of got bigger and bigger since 2000, say. Hmm. And then what basically happened was, so my wife worked in the Gender Identity Development Service, and she was used to working with people psychologically, and she thought that's what would be going on in the service. And then she was listening to cases, and some of the cases, after quite a few short number of consultations, would be sent off to UCL for medication. She raised questions about this, saying what was going on, and surely these are quite complicated presentations, kids with comorbid symptoms, they may have eating disorders, be on the autistic spectrum, or have ADHD. And it takes a bit of time to sort of unpack what's going on for them, both individually, but also with the family. And she felt they were being moved into a sort of medical pathway too quickly. She tried to discuss that with the team and felt that her concerns and questions were not welcome. So after about 6 months, she took it up with the medical director. He then looked into her concerns and he found that he upheld what she was worried about. He felt there was not enough research, there was not enough outcome monitoring, there wasn't enough rigorous clinical thought about who these kids were, why they were presenting with this particular symptom, what might be going on behind the scenes, and that the whole thing was too rushed. They were being rushed down a narrow medical pathway before proper, thorough psychological work had been done. The thing about that was, I was part of the management of the trust, and what we'd usually do is we'd hear about these reports. They'd all be discussed by all the managers in the trust. And Dave Taylor's report, he was the medical director at the time, it basically disappeared. My wife resigned and she left the Gender Identity Disorder Service. She didn't feel she could work with that team. Now, then if you sort of roll on, what happened was I retired from the NHS in 2018. I took up a role on the Board of Governors. That's a voluntary role. It's not a paid role. And another colleague of mine, probably the best known clinician in the trust, a guy called David Bell, he was approached by staff from the Gender Identity Disorder Service, who basically were saying similar things to the concerns that my wife had raised in 2005. He told the trust he'd like to do a report as a governor. He did the report, and then they really didn't like the findings because the findings basically said, we're not looking at these kids psychologically thoroughly, all the things that Sue had raised in 2005. Now, what then happened was the board's job is to oversee the functioning of the trust. Now, for 6 months, I was trying to bring up the fact that these are serious concerns about a very vulnerable group of children. It's an experimental medical treatment. We don't really know what the outcome of these medical interventions are. They're serious. And there wasn't the usual sort of body of evidence that surrounds this sort of medical intervention. Over time, what I realized was that the trust weren't really interested in looking into it. I felt that the whole thing was being buried, and I felt this was negligent on behalf of the part of the trust. This was a negligent approach. You should take these serious concerns seriously. After all, it's a controversial treatment with a vulnerable group with serious long-term consequences. Now, I'd signed a non-disclosure?
Yeah, NDA.
NDA that basically said I couldn't say anything as long as I was on the Board of Governors. Right. So I resigned, and then something strange happened. All of a sudden, I was contacted by all sorts of journalists who were already ahead of the curve on this. They had all sorts of questions.
Wow, yeah.
And then I was asked to speak at the House of Lords with a group of clinicians from the States and from people like Stephanie Davis-Arai. Mm-hmm. And what was clear was there were all sorts of concerns, both here and in the States, about the fact that we're basically flying blind with this medical intervention.
What are, just quickly, some of the most egregious things that have happened to mostly, I suppose, children, were they?
These were all under 18s. The JID service is under 18s, yeah.
What are some of the most egregious things where it's like gone too far and that you've gone, oh, this shouldn't have happened?
Well, the first thing is you put a block on puberty, and the argument was by the Gender Identity Development Service that you can just, if the kid isn't ready for puberty, some kids find it, you know, it's traumatic. because there are all sorts of changes, physical changes. There's a change in your psychology. There's a change in your expectations. In a way, you're moving from the relatively protected world of that a child lives in to the world that we live in as adults, where there are all sorts of expectations. What are you going to do in the world? What about sexual relationships? Are you going to have these expectations all of a sudden start coming in on you? Now, what happens in adolescence is often that stirs up all sorts of confusions about your body, about your psychology, about who you are, about where you fit in with society. And what I would say is that sort of confusion is part of the adolescent process. Mm-hmm. And you, as parents or as clinicians, you understand, you're sympathetic to the fact this is very turbulent, sometimes quite disturbing, but you sort of support the individual in living through that process. Now, what the gender identity development service did is basically put a block on puberty, which sort of stops the hormonal development, which stops this turbulent developmental process. The idea being you could sort of all of a sudden you could lift the lid and then all of a sudden the hormones would kick in. The problem is that it's not quite as straightforward as that. There are all sorts of concerns about the effect of puberty blockers in terms of bone marrow development, brain development. The other thing is you're taking the kid and their turbulent development out of their peer group and sort of, it's like putting them back a year in class.
Yeah.
So it's not the neutral act that it's said to be.
Mm. It's experimental, isn't it?
And it's experimental. It's an off-licence drug for this treatment.
So puberty blockers, hormones, were they sort of pushing kids towards surgical operations?
No, so the next thing would be you go to cross-sex hormones and that's when you start to, again, interfere with the sort of normal process of the physiological development of the child. And beyond a certain point, you trace cross-sex hormones, it has all sorts of implications for how your body develops. My other point is it has all sorts of implications for how you might struggle with all sorts of things about your identity, your psychology, your sexual preferences. You know, this, I see it a lot of the time, you see kids, and that really they're terrified of the adult world. They're terrified of the developmental process. They're often quite, now this is a generalization, but the kids we see, they're often quite fragile and they feel worried about their identity at the best of the times. You throw in the turbulence of adolescence and then they feel they're losing control. And in a way, all these drugs sort of put a lid on things.
I see.
So many of them are, again, this is a generalization, so I'm talking about the kids that I see in private practice. They're sort of trying to control the turbulence that's been unleashed by puberty and by sexual development.
That's fascinating. I'm really fascinated. I really like that you said that because I know I used to have quite bad obsessive compulsive disorder when I was a teenager. I had to see someone about it. I was flipping light switches on and off all the time and all that kind of thing. And it took a long time to understand the relationship between that and control and how we all seem to need to control our environment in some way. Like, does that make sense to you? Is that most people need in some way to control their environment?
100%. You know, that a lot of these kids comorbidly, they're on the autistic spectrum, they've got eating disorders, all these things are to do with control of the internal world and the external world.
Yeah. And you can't control everything. And sometimes you have to go through these things and just work with a therapist, perhaps, but without all of these drugs. I mean, that was very worrying for you.
Well, one of the things was the other thing that Hilary Cass mentions in the review is she talks about it, the American approach, which is affirmation, which has been adopted in this country and in the States. The biggest researcher in the game is Ken Zucker. He is the person that's done most research in this area, and his approach was watchful waiting. That was the old approach. And that has been researched. And basically what it says is, if you stand by these kids, they're going through gender dysphoria and turbulence, something like 80% of them will desist. Their symptoms will desist if you support them and stand by them, you know, and help them get through the turbulence, if you like. Now, that has been controversially, that approach has been controversially ditched in preference for affirmation, in which you go along with the child or young person's idea that they're born in the wrong body, and that if only they could change gender, then all their problems would be relieved.
Mm-hmm. Were these mostly girls?
So this is the other thing. So, you know, I've been in psychiatry since 1980. The first 20 years of my time in psychiatry, the cohort you're dealing with, a very small number of mainly males transitioning to females post 18. What's happened since 2000 is you've got this huge increase in younger and younger kids, mainly girls transitioning to boys at the point of puberty. So it's a completely different cohort. And that was the other thing that is so characteristic of this is no one seems very interested in what's going on. You might say in society, there are all sorts of concerns about girls' development, over-sexualization, you know, yeah, all sorts of things, but no one seems interested in that. We're sort of, again, as in so many ways in this area, we're sort of flying blind, and all curiosity is looked upon as if it's a sort of problem rather than actually the clinical people involved sort of behaving ethically in terms of trying to understand something.
I don't want to keep going on about it, but that control aspect I find so fascinating, just because I know I did a lot of work on exorcism. I went and followed an exorcist, and the exorcisees, person after person after person, were young girls, 17 years old, 16, 15 years old, who were clearly trying to assert some control over their lives. And they happen to live in a time and place over in the suburbs of Buenos Aires where the thing to do then is you're told there's a demon inside you, and almost like you're in the wrong body. There's something wrong inside of you, and we have to have this really intrusive thing, which is an exorcism, to get it out. And it does seem to help them for 6 months or a few months or a year, because there's the initial kind of placebo, there's the initial excitement and the energy that comes from it, but it doesn't really reframe any kind of disorders or any issues that they've got. Does that sound very similar to you? And not just because I guess the other one is we're talking about social contagion, I suppose, would be eating disorders. Yeah. That's another one.
Yeah.
I remember hearing that Japan didn't have that at all. And then American movies came out and it came to Japan. Does this all ring a bell?
It does. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, if you know, in terms of, my wife and I have got a clinical practice at home that we set that up after I resigned and she took the judicial review with Kira Bell. We'll come on to that in a bit, I dare say. Mm. But a lot of the kids that come to see us, that you describe them as lost.
Yeah.
You know, they're focusing down on something called their gender. But if you look behind that, which is what we're interested in doing, is seeing who is this person? And that often they're quite lost as people. They haven't found their place in society, and they are worried about who they are and where they're going to fit in. Mm. Now, what happens is that online, often they find places where they're sort of welcome, and they join the online groups, and they're very influenced by them. Now, that's unusual for teenagers and adolescents. They're looking for peer groups where they feel they fit. Now, a little point here is that often that what happens in this area is that people sort of overclaim, in my view. They're all this, they're all that, they're all the other. My view is there's all sorts of things going on here. So I would say social contagion is extremely important. You've got rather young people who are anxious about their identity, they haven't found their place in the world, and they're prone to being influenced by external groups who say, this is your problem and this is the solution. Behind that, what you often find is that the individual themselves are also struggling. They're particularly prone because they feel quite fragile. Their identities, all of our identities in adolescence are sort of wobbly and not that secure, but they're particularly anxious about themselves. And they deal with that by trying to look for some belief system which will eradicate the sort of conflicts, the complexities, just get rid of that problem.
Yeah. I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, 2 carry on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink. Grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded. Both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favourite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
This episode is brought to you by Liquid IV. When you hydrate with Liquid IV, you're powered by HydraScience. HydraScience is Liquid IV's science-backed formula with an optimized ratio of electrolytes, vitamins, and nutrients. Experience great-tasting hydration for mental clarity, physical endurance, and overall well-being. Sip into something that up-levels every moment. Liquid IV. Tear. Pour. Live more. Visit us at liquidiv.com.
The other thing I'll say, this is just a bit historical, is that there's so much false science in this area. It's a wash with false science. And that existed in the 1980s. I used to run the parasuicide service at King's. And what we were told, I'm talking about the old cohort, the male to female, what we were told is that all but 1% of people who transition make a successful transition. Well, I can tell you that we used to see quite a lot of people who'd had problems. They believed that sexual reassignment surgery would solve their problems. That didn't solve the problems, and then they took an overdose afterwards. And it was quite a large proportion. So this false science claim, you know, is only 1%. There's very little research. These sort of statistics and views are sort of peddled out as if they're sort of something called reliable science. They're absolutely not.
Wow. It reminds me again, I'm not going to keep going back to it.
Yeah.
There was a woman who got an exorcism. She thought it helped her. And I went back to see her a year later and she wasn't better because she had, you know, real issues, of course. And she said that what she was going to do is do a multiple exorcism. She'd found a new priest who was going to give her, and it was going to be like, she was going to get exercised like 10 times a day or something, which reminds me of the overdosing. I mean, she's gone back to go further into this, and it's not the right path. She's not being well advised, unfortunately. Tell me about Kira Bell then, the Kira Bell case.
Yeah, the Kira Bell case. Well, after there was this presentation at the House of Lords, it was very striking meeting because the woman who organized it, Posy Parker, she sent out an invite to every MP and every member of the Lords. What's that, about 1,500 people? 2 people came. Lord Mooney, who you've got to host the event, and Lord Mooney, had been a member of the Labour Party for something like 40 years. He was warned that if he hosted the meeting, he would have the Labour Party whip withdrawn, and that's what happened.
Which, but for non-Brits, that's just a punishment for politicians.
Punishment for politicians. So the fact that we're just debating clinically a treatment we do with kids, and everybody's been forbidden from attending. So you realise you're in a very peculiar world.
Yeah.
Coming out of that, usually I would be an advocate for saying, well, in medicine, you've got various different approaches. You've got debate and discussion. You've got research. You've got follow-up. And then a sort of consensus arises. And then, by and large, most medics stick with the medical consensus for treatment. But what do you do when the medics have been captured by a particular ideology or belief system that isn't rigorously looking at and debating and looking at the downside of treatment and the outcomes? So Sue started with Mother A. Mother A was the mother of a autistic kid who she felt was vulnerable to being pulled into the trans cult. They started the judicial review. And Keira Bell contacted Sue as someone who was seen four times at the Tavistock and had various different interventions as a result. I think Keira would say, you know, she had a troubled past and background. That wasn't really looked into. You know, she was very determined. She thought, this is my problem. This is my solution. I just want the medicalized approach.
To be a boy.
So she would say she was quite fixed in her belief, but having gone through all the treatments, and this happens with some of the detransitioners, and suddenly she felt, actually, I'm not sure this was right. And certainly she thought, I don't think the mental health services had really looked into what was going on for me. But just another little thing, you see, that often the gender identity development services say, is they said, well, the kid was quite certain. Now, often when kids are very worried, they look for certainty. They nail their colours to a particular mast. And for me, the fact that there's no room for doubt, there's no room to tolerate confusion, is a red flag. And I would say, I think that's problematic. You're about to do something which has got long-term implications for you as a person, which will end up with sterility and sort of no way back. You should have doubts and confusions. You should be worried. But often it's put forward as if the fixed belief is sort of confirmation that we're going in the right direction, rather than there's a lack of flexibility in the child's thought, and that needs exploring.
Absolutely. I mean, we all know kids who are damn certain of things. I was saying to Stella O'Malley recently about, I remember getting some David Beckham football boots that I knew were too small for me, but in my head, I was convinced they were right because they were the only ones in the shop. And I made my parents get, I was like, I need these. I will not be okay unless I have these football boots. Within a few days, I'm like, well, they're squishing my feet. Like, this is ridiculous. What have I done? You need parents, I suppose. Parents are there to look around the next corner for you.
No, absolutely. And the thing is that one of the things, the problem with the affirmation model, I'm all for, you know, my starting point is to try and understand where the individual's coming from. The individual's suffering, they feel they're in pain, they feel they've got a solution. I want to tune in to how do they see the world? Why do they think this is the solution? Where I would part company with affirmation is I would say, but having been in mental health, you know, for 45 years, people come with all sorts of fixed beliefs. My job's not to confirm their beliefs. An anorexic comes and says, I don't think I need food. My job's to understand, look, you may think food is poison. I get that. It's very distressing when the nurses insist that you eat your meal. But I'm here because I want to understand why you think like this and what this is all about. That's felt to be destructive to the individual's belief system, as if you're traumatizing them. Well, that's the art of mental health work.
Yeah.
You're not trying to bang heads or traumatize the individual, but neither are you colluding with what might be a false belief. Beliefs can be treacherous, like you say, in your David Beckham size whatever boots.
Yeah. Or the girls who wanted exorcisms. They were convinced, even after the exorcism, I'm wonderful now, I'm fine, I'm absolutely great. A year later, no good, and traumatized by the actual experience, which is a horrific one, of being exorcised. Absolutely bonkers. And also, how insulting, I think, is this view to therapists who... You know, it's not an easy job. And the idea, they're sort of suggesting, yeah, you're just supposed to sit there and nod your head at everything that they say.
Well, tolerating, you know, I talked about the sort of fragility of a lot of the kids I see. You see, sort of tolerating conflict and different parts of ourselves is part of the maturational process. Mm. When you get to 62, my age, you know, you realize you're making the best of a bad job. You know, you've got all sorts of things about yourself which you'd, you know, a bit of a podgy nose, ears that stick out, and all sorts of character flaws. You know, but we're trying to sort of make the best. I think the idea that you're trying to eradicate something which is problematic and then become this sort of ideal that you've got in your mind, you know, we all have those ideas about ourselves, but the job of mental health professionals and parents, as you say, is sometimes to say, well, hang on, let's give this a bit of time. We might have to get to tolerate the fact you're not very good at maths, but that doesn't mean you give up maths at the earliest opportunity. You know, we're trying to tolerate our imperfections, not eradicate them.
Yeah, I feel like some of the greatest atrocities in human history come from that pursuit of the ideal and that failure, no matter how many times it happens, that failure to start to learn and understand that sometimes we are just making the best of a bad lot. It's difficult being human. We were talking just before, as I always do, just in case anyone wants to know what I talk about before we go on the podcast, it's death and misery. I was talking about, you know, it's not great that you're born into with a brain that starts to realize that you're going to die. That's awful. There's almost nothing as cruel as that in nature. And there's a lot of stuff that's just not ideal, and you just have to do the best you can with it. And I remember as well, when I first went to therapy, I had a fixed idea. My fixed idea was that everyone else in my life was annoying and difficult and rubbish, and I was great. And if the therapist had just affirmed me, I wouldn't be happy at all. I'd be getting into all sorts of arguments with people, not understanding the world. If they'd said, well, those people do seem destructive in your life. And instead the therapist was like, well, maybe they are, maybe they're not, but you've got to learn to accept some things. That was so helpful for me. How did Kira Bell, were there lasting issues for her? Is she able to continue being just a girl or a woman as she would have been?
Well, I mean, Kira Bell, I think, has done an amazing job in a very thoughtful way, drawing attention to the problem in this area. And she continues to do that. Mm. But obviously, Kira's trying to get on with her life, and you've got to sort of, you know, she would have every right to be very aggrieved about what was done. I think the lack of thought, I think she's sympathetic to the fact she was very fixed in her view and she would say quite hard to argue with. And this is where clinicians need support in being able to not bang heads with the individuals they're seeing, but to have the experience to sort of find different ways. What I tend to think of is the individual comes, as I say, with this fixed idea. And my job is, I don't tend to focus on gender. My job is to think, who is this person? I'm assuming, as a member of the human condition, like all of us, got all sorts of strengths, weaknesses, worries, conflicts going on behind this narrow preoccupation in the family, within themselves. What's I'm interested in that. Who is this person? So I think that now the thing is, when you you can get into sort of a sort of loggerhead situation when you're the clinician, you're felt to be the one who's opposing the person in front of you and is sort of making things worse. Mm. I've got the solution. You're asking all these questions. That's making me feel worse. Again, part of the skill is to be find a way of interesting in the individual in what until this point they couldn't be interested in, namely the conflicts and the difficulties. But Kira, yeah, I mean, the other thing in life you've got to do, isn't it, is we've got our grievances, things we don't like about ourselves, things, as you were saying, we don't like about others. Mm. But at a certain sort of point, one's coming to let go of those grievances, mourn the fact that we're not ideal, neither are the people, neither are our parents, neither is our therapist, and then we sort of move on in life. But sometimes people get stuck in that position, as you said, of just searching for the ideal. They feel the only way they can live a life is if either they're ideal or if everyone else is ideal. And of course, that brings them into conflict all the time with other people, or they narrow their field of vision. You know, dare say you started to sort of get rid of various different friends who annoyed you too much. Well, then you end up in the end on your own.
Absolutely.
Not really a solution to being a human being in a human world.
Never learning. So, yeah. So what is it about Tavistock? Because my impression of the culture in general, even in newspapers, TV channels, they're reporting trans people, who, you know, men who say they're women as women now. The culture seems to be on board with that. So what was it about Tavistock that got it? You know, was it sued? Was it shut down, I believe? What? Why that one is like that? No, that was too far.
So what happened with the judicial review that Kira Bell took over was that three High Court judges looked at the evidence from Kira Bell's side and from the Tavistock side and basically came to the conclusion there was no evidence that justified the medicalization of kids and them giving informed consent at the age of 12 for a treatment which would end up with them being sterilized by the time they're, you know, whatever age.
It's a house of horrors.
And they said that they didn't think this was right. And they made this ruling, but they looked at all the evidence. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it was really at one point, I think, they looked at the fact that a lot of this is based on the Dutch protocol. That was a study that was done a long time ago on 70 boys, 20 of whom dropped out. I mean, this is not gold standard research, and there are all sorts of questions about the methodology now anyway. So the judge's questions was, where's the rest of the evidence? You're the national service. What have you been doing? Well, the answer is, as the medical director told me in my last meeting at the Board of Governors, I said, where's the follow-up? There is none. They just didn't follow anyone up. So they had no idea what happens to these kids. Okay, so the Kira Bell won that judicial review. Then the government asked Hilary Cass, who's a paediatrician with a stellar reputation, to look at, with no skin in the game, to look at where are we with the medicalization of gender dysphoric kids. And she did an interim report, and the interim report basically says the same thing as David Bell said, as David Taylor said in 2006, not enough evidence, yeah, not enough thought, not enough scrutiny. So the Tavistock was then decommissioned effectively. It had a very bad CQC. The notes were very bad. So the sort of risk assessment. So one of your earlier questions is, one of the things that you would think you're looking at is when a young person has got in their mind the girl or boy that they would prefer to be, are they aware that there is going to be a difference between the image that they've got in their minds and the physical reality? And how will they deal with the gap between what they imagine is going to be the case and what is actually the case?
The gap between the idealist and acceptance of life.
100%. Now, that's important because if they're not in touch with reality in that way, they're going to get a terrible depression because, you know, a created man or a created woman is not the same as a biologically born man or woman. There's a big gap. And people talk about passing, and people talk about they go through, you know, all the various things that medical science has got to offer, and they still know in themselves that they're not natally male or female. So even if they pass, they still know themselves. So how are they going to deal with these the pain of these realities? And that sort of thing needs to be worked out and thought through. I think the note keeping was extremely poor and weak, and so they got the service got a very poor report from this overseeing body. Anyway, the service has been decommissioned and it's meant to be moved to three other sites, but there are all sorts of problems with setting it up. Partly because, in some senses, you know, you've got a problem where the people who want to work in these services are either sort of wedded to the affirmation model, which has already been found to be problematic, and other people don't want to go and work in these services. So I think there are problems setting them up, there are problems attracting staff, there are problems educating staff. They're hard to get off the ground.
This is a minefield. What do you think it is that leads certain doctors or scientists and researchers to so fervently push something when they should be being a little bit more restrained and nuanced?
It's a very good question. The thing is that a patient comes to you in pain and you want to remove the pain. The problem is, it's a bit like the opioid scandal in America, you know, that often you can give a solution to a problem which has got a short-term solution with long-term hidden consequences. And your duty as a medic is to be aware of the bigger picture and the longer picture. You may be solving a problem in the short term, but there's a nasty sting in the tail in the long term. And, you know, has the patient thought about that? And have you thought about it as well? So another thing that's very important to say is a lot of the staff in the JID service were relatively newly qualified staff. They're then meeting patients who are in a lot of distress, putting them under a lot of pressure to send them on a medical pathway. And it takes quite a bit of experience neither to get into an argument nor to collude. And that sort of experience sometimes it's not always like this, but, you know, it comes with training and with age. And if that's missing, you're more likely to go down the line of least resistance, you know, for good reasons. You want to relieve pain.
Yeah, yeah. It all comes from a fairly good place, I believe.
It comes
that
from a fairly
well.
Good place, yeah.
People
yeah.
want to help.
Yeah.
But they're just, yeah, yeah, sometimes you need, I mean, it's cruel to be kind sometimes.
With Walmart's new fresh and frozen subscriptions, you can save time on your weekly grocery shopping.
Dad, you're supposed to be grocery shopping.
And miss the chance to embarrass you in front of your friends? I subscribe to snacks and wet napkins. You know how messy you are.
Dad!
Walmart. Subscribe to your weekly list.
This episode is brought to you by Experian. Are you paying for subscriptions you don't use, but can't find the time or energy to cancel them? Experian could cancel unwanted subscriptions for you, saving you an average of $270 per year and plenty of time. Download the Experian app. Results will vary. Not all subscriptions are eligible. Savings are not guaranteed. Paid membership with connected payment account required.
The other thing is you do get the problem of the omnipotence of medicine. You know, the belief, which is very appealing to certain individuals, we can do anything in medicine. And the patient says, well, I'd like you to do, you know, produce a miracle for me. And you will find that surgeons, very proud and interested in their trade, again, not bad people, but thinking, yeah, you're a natal man and I can turn you into a natal woman. That's, you know, it's very appealing to people's narcissism, but it's not reality.
If it were possible, I suppose in some, I don't know, fictitious future, would that be a good idea? If you could, when someone comes in and says, hey, I feel like I'm a boy and I'm actually a girl, and if you could perform that kind of, like, boom, and you are a boy, is that not even a question? Is that not even a possibility as a question?
Well, I think, you know, one of the difficulties we all have is having to, like you were saying, you know, beyond the fitting into David Beckham's boots, you're going to become David Beckham, you see, and we all need to believe, you know, that maybe we will, or maybe we'll become Shakespeare, or maybe it's, you know, this is a very natural part of all of us and of, you know, of growing up. But developmentally, it's important that at a certain stage, one begins to realize the difference between our realistic abilities, our wishes, and our illusions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that we all have fantasies about what we'd like to happen, which are out of touch with reality. That's universal. What's helpful is when we can differentiate. If we start to confuse fantasy and reality in an ongoing way, you tend to hit against reality.
Mm.
And that is a lot of, you know, what we're dealing with in psychiatry is helping, it's not eradicate people's fantasies and their imagination, but it's trying to help people differentiate those different states of mind.
What are the rules or the laws right now around if a child, somebody under 18, wants to undergo puberty blockers, different hormones and things like that? Are they able to? And to what extent does parental permission play a part?
Well, what happened after the first judicial review was the Tavistock appealed. And then what people claim is the Tavistock won the second case. What actually happened was the judge in charge decided it wasn't a matter for the courts. It was a matter for medics. The judging panel didn't look at any of the evidence. It was just thrown back to the medics as if to say, this is not a legal matter. You guys have got to sort this out.
Hmm.
But that's when Hilary Cass came in with the view that she would have a look at what the state of play was and that she would give a ruling on, you know, where she felt the evidence of the medicine was, which is there isn't much. Yeah. And what there is of very poor quality.
Right. So where does that leave us then with a law for children taking hormones?
Well, I think that some of the private centres, I think there are sort of more checks and balances. I think that certainly for the under 18s, there are, you know, you'd have to be ignoring the first judicial review. You'd have to ignore the current evidence, which is coming out, which is all the Scandinavian countries are also following us in saying, hang on, we need to have another look here. There isn't enough evidence to justify what we've been doing. So let's pause a halt. Mm-hmm. Let's have a halt on medicalization of under 18s. I think what's happening in the NHS is people are extremely reluctant to now give puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones for minors.
Mm-hmm.
You can still go to gender GP in the private sector, and people are getting stuff off the internet.
Okay. I've got a line here. In 2021, the Court of Appeal ruled that children will be allowed to take puberty blockers without parental consent. The NHS said it aimed to start a study by next year. This was 2023 when that was written, of puberty blockers on gender dysphoria in children and young people with early onset gender dysphoria. So I think the reason you don't know is because nobody appears to know right now. They're at a real sort of in-between stage.
I had a mind block then. Yeah, Hilary Cass basically said any medication for kids, it's got to be part of a research trial. It's just come back to me. And that she has got in Simon Wesley, who's the top sort of research professor in psychiatry in this country, I think, to oversee some, you know, rigorous, thorough research in this area. Okay. So, yeah, you're right. It's not a complete embargo, but it's got to be part of a research study. Now, whether that applies in the private sector, I don't think it does, but I'm not sure.
And at Tavistock, was that happening, that children were getting these things, not necessarily with the permission of their parents?
Yeah, no, they didn't need the permission of their parents. I mean, they would seek the permission of their parents, but they didn't need it.
Man, can you imagine that? Your kids have gone and you've okay, well, it's the NHS. I trust in these institutions. And you send your kid who's going through some difficulties and they come out and they've like not gone through puberty or something as a result.
Well, some parents, the families that we tend to see, and it's only a small private psychotherapy practice, we get a letter from parents twice, three times a week. The letter's the same. I'm very worried about my son and daughter. They've had long-standing comorbid problems.
This is your current therapy now.
This is our current therapy now. We have we get these letters. They went to see a counsellor the other day, and they've come back with this belief, and they're spending a lot of time online, and they suddenly come up with the idea that they need to transition. And we are worried because we don't think there's enough scrutiny, evaluation. Yeah. Will you please see them? Now, so, you know, that we get a lot of kids like that and a lot of parents like that. Now, one of the things that, the trans lobbies do is they try to divide parents and kids, and you do see parents are often terrified to take things up with their kids because they feel that they might lose the kid. I mean, there was this thing about, you know, would you rather have a live trans kid or a dead kid?
Yeah.
Again, that's all pseudoscience, all been blown out of proportion. This group are no more risky than adolescents with comorbid problems. They're in the same category, but it gets used as a sort of gun to hold to parents' heads. And then the other thing is, of course, that often online, you know, they get advised that you need to get rid of your parents and just exclude them out of your life. And it does happen.
Very cultish, that is.
Very cultish.
Excommunicate your parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So now, yeah.
What about why autism? Why the language? And I've watched some of that Love on the Spectrum program on Netflix, as autistic children, young people meeting other young people and so on. I do get the feeling watching, and correct me if I'm wrong, that firstly, they don't seem to have too much concern for what sex they are and who they're attracted to either. I don't mean to say that autistic people don't have sexual attraction in the same way that other people don't, but on that show in particular, it would be like, oh, I fancy a boy. Oh, no, I like a girl now. And I never heard them go, wow, I'm attracted to this person. It felt like a partner.
So again, not to generalize, because I'm talking about the group that we see, which is a small sort of cohort. But as I said to you earlier, often sex is a sort of, if you looked at, it's not quite like this, but if you looked at a sort of child growing up in a way, if you're lucky, you know, your parents are looking after you, they worry about you, they're concerned about you. I know I'm painting an ideal picture.
Sure.
But the sort of load of anxiety is sort of shared with the parents. And then you're moving into adulthood, you're becoming more independent, you might rebel against your parents, that's what, you know, in some ways it needs to happen. And then all of a sudden someone throws in a huge stone into the pond of childhood called sexuality. Now that creates all sorts of disturbances, and that with autistic kids, you know, emotional disturbance and conflict is the thing that they're struggling with. They're wanting to sort of control. They're struggling enough to deal with the frustrations of, no, you've got to leave that toy behind. That's not yours. And yeah, but I want to take it. And, you know, I'm simplifying things. But you throw the sexuality into the pond, and and the developmental process that I described before, you're moving towards adulthood, it raises all sorts of additional conflicts and anxieties. And a lot of the kids that we see are wanting to put a lid on sexuality because it as you were talking about earlier on, it gives them more of a sense of control of their emotional world and of the expectations of the world around them.
Interesting. So they're particularly vulnerable.
And a sort of the other thing is, you know, to tolerate the confusion that comes with development. You know, what am I going to be? Am I going to be a sort of, some sort of heroic figure? I'm a more artistic figure. I'm sort of a new romantic. Next one week, I'm a punk the next, you know. These sort of experimenting with identity and who we are and who we're attracted to, this is all part of the adolescent process and needs to play its way out. And by this sort of trans process puts a lid on all that.
Wow. Okay. It has to play its way out without anything permanent, the permanent intervention.
Yeah.
Where do you want to send people to look you up or follow your work?
Well, my wife and I, after the judicial review and after being contacted by lots of parents, we wrote our book basically is about a psychological approach to thinking about gender dysphoria. And our view is this is what the Tavistock should have been doing. Mm-hmm. You know, our national psychotherapy training institution should have been thinking about the individual psychology and the family dynamics that lead to this presentation. I want to say, see, once you get over 18, it's not that I'm completely against transition. I'm not completely against transition. Some people make successful transitions, and I've got nothing against that. And I'm very familiar with that in the first 20 years of my psychiatric practice. I think that you've got to be very careful with kids. I think, whether or not you transition, you're needing to think about what are the sort of underlying drivers, motives, conflicts. What are you struggling with? Mm. And if you've got more of an understanding of what's going on for you under the surface, you're in a better position, not for me to tell you what to do, but for you to decide what your decisions and thinking are based on. And that's what I think is missing. Thorough assessment and then psychological work, whether it's with the family, whether it's with the kid, whether it's with the young adult, to really think these things through. And, you know, and that's how it used to be. Prior to the age at which you could start to transition, being under 18, it always used to be 18. You had to, the National Centre was at Charing Cross. You'd have 2 years living as the opposite sex and having 2 years of psychotherapy. And for me, I thought that was a model that protected people from making quick decisions which they might regret.
And that's what you've written about.
That's basically in the
book. That's the most important part of you. Sorry, you've got to tell people where to get your book.
Yeah, that's right. So gender dysphoria, a model for understanding, treatment and care of gender dysphoric kids. Yeah.
Okay. Who's a heretic you admire?
Well, Freud was a heretic in his day. He was actually a neurologist, and because he was Jewish, he wasn't accepted into neurology, and ended up thankfully going into psychiatry.
Wow!
Because I think I'm not a Freud scholar, but I think he was, his passage in the sort of highly respected area of neurology. I mean, he did quite a lot of work in neurology, but it was thwarted. He had there was a glass ceiling, as they say. So he went into psychiatry because, I guess no one was that interested in what went on in psychiatry.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
I think that's right. Yeah. Mm.
Thank you, Marcus Evans. Are we vindicated? Is that what this means? I don't know. Let me know by sharing this all around on the social medias and all of those things with your views and comments. I'm sure a few of them will be angry because that's the way. Get hold of my book, The Psychology of Secrets. It's out. I don't know when this episode is out, but really very, very soon. Kindle, Audible, the audio version, which I read, or the book itself, the hardback, which you can get delivered from England, I believe. So go and have a look at all that online. The Psychology of Secrets by me, Andrew Gold. Marcus Evans, go and follow him. Go see what's up with him. I'll put his links in the description. Thank you, Marcus, for coming on. Absolutely brilliant. Really interesting guy with some fascinating thoughts. And I'll see you guys next time.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.